Church. My name is Lindsey Williams, one of the pastors here. If this is your first Sunday here at Midtown, on September 10th, we're going to be kicking off the fall with a new sermon series on the New Testament book of 1 Peter. I'm really excited about that. And so I want you to not only be here on September 10th, but I'd also really encourage you to use this as an opportunity. Invite your friends and your neighbors, whether you've been at Midtown for 5 months or 2 weeks, or 5 years. Encourage you, bring friends and neighbors to join us as we begin that new sermon series. For the next 2 weeks, though, we are going to continue our summer sermon series on what it means for us as a church to live on mission, to live for other people. And today we're looking at this passage in John 4, and we're going to use it as a case study to learn from an individual about what it looks like to live on mission. Now, the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman, I've always been fascinated by the story. And in particular, I'm fascinated by how effective this woman's ministry was. Because on the surface, she feels like Michael Scott from the TV show The Office. So bear with me, but The Office, if you haven't seen the show, it's a great show, a comedy. It centers on the working relationships within the branch of a paper supply company called Dunder Mifflin. And the manager of this office is Michael Scott, played by actor Steve Carell. And he is probably the most dysfunctional and inept manager that I could possibly imagine. And every episode involves him making a complete and utter fool of himself and everybody else in the office trying to understand how it is that he's got the corner office and they are sitting there in cubicles. Well, one of my favorite episodes is when Michael Scott finds out that his branch in Scranton had the best sales of any Dunder Mifflin branch for that entire year. And so the corporate executives, they ask him to go to each of the branches of Dunder Mifflin to talk about the secret sauce, that the key to their success. And so he goes kind of on a lecture circuit to each of the branches. And what's interesting is every time he gives a lecture, the more convinced people are, they have absolutely no clue how this branch was so successful. He's just a bumbling idiot. And on the surface, when you look at this passage in John 4, you get a similar vibe from this Samaritan woman. Now, I want to spend the majority of our time on what happens after her encounter with Jesus. But in order to really appreciate what happens after, you got to have a sense of what took place when her and Jesus first met. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about the long-standing conflict between Jews and Samaritans in ancient Palestine. You know, even as I considered this passage in John 4, it has a lot of similarities to some of the conflicts that have been in the news the past few weeks. Things have been very racially charged here in the U.S., particularly in the past 3 weeks. Well, Jews and Samaritans were similarly different races who, generally speaking, made a point of avoiding personal interaction with one another whenever possible. Here's an example of this. If a Jew had to travel from Judea to Galilee, the most direct route would take them straight through Samaria. But Jews hated Samaritans so much that they would add 70 miles to their journey. They would cross over the Jordan River twice just so they had to make sure they could not be in the presence of a Samaritan. That's how committed they were to avoiding them. And that is what makes this passage so shocking. Because here you have Jesus. He was in Judea. He needed to go to Galilee. And here's a Jewish man who does what no Jew in his day would ever do. He took the direct route. If you look at the verse 1 of our passage, we're told, and Jesus had to pass through Samaria. Now, it's an interesting choice of words, because the whole point is that the historical precedent is set precisely that you don't have to go through Samaria if you are a Jew. You go an extra 70 miles to avoid it. But Jesus felt so compelled to go through Samaria that it was as if he had to do it. And it was there that he went to get water at a well. He struck up a conversation with a Samaritan woman who was there for the same purpose. And that's when Jesus began a conversation with her. And he began talking to her about a different kind of water. A living water. And this living water that Jesus had to offer, it could change her life. And then, out of nowhere, the conversation suddenly gets really awkward. Jesus says to the woman, hey, go call your husband and bring him back here. Now, this woman, up until this point, she was a chatty Cathy. She was talking up a storm. But then at this moment, when he mentions her husband, it's as if the record stops and everybody at the dance party suddenly stares at the two people. It gets really quiet. And she responds, I have no husband. To give you a sense of how things really changed in this conversation, up until this point in their dialogue, this woman used anywhere from 11 to 42 words in her responses to Jesus' questions. But in her response to Jesus' question, come and bring your husband, it is in Greek only 3 words. Any person with an ounce of social skills would realize, I just said something to this woman that impacted her emotionally. It shut her down. It would almost be the equivalent of a man asking a woman who isn't pregnant, are you having a boy or a girl? You know, the only thing worse than asking that question is asking that question when you know she isn't pregnant. And that's what Jesus did. The passage, it says, Jesus, you're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you've had 5 husbands, and the man that you're now currently shacking up with is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. And this makes Jesus look even worse on the surface. He knew that she didn't have a husband. He knew that she'd been married 5 previous times. And then this conversation, it turns into a debate about monuments. Now, that's a relevant topic, isn't it? You know, if you remember a few weeks ago when we were looking at the parable of the Good Samaritan, the end result of the conflict between the Jews and the Samaritans is that the Samaritans had to build a temple on a different mountain because the Jews did not want the Samaritans worshiping with them on the mountain where Jerusalem was. And so you had 2 groups of people who are now presently fighting over which monument should remain standing and which monument should be torn down. And this Samaritan woman wanted to know who's right. Whose monument is the place where you find the presence of God? The woman said to Jesus, I know that the Messiah is coming. And when he comes, he's going to explain everything to us. Meaning, when this Messiah comes, he will tell us which monument is the right monument where we can find the good life, where we can find God. And then at this moment, Jesus tells this woman something that he has never explicitly told another human being up until this point in time. He says, I who speak to you am he. This is the first person to whom Jesus actually revealed explicitly that he was indeed God. And he revealed it to a person who is considered to be the wrong race, who worships at the wrong monument, and if you understand the patriarchal society of Jesus' day, she also was the wrong gender. And he revealed it to a woman who had had 5 failed marriages and was currently shacking up with a guy who she wasn't married to. And this gets to why I say on the surface she feels kind of like Michael Scott from The Office. Because you look at her credentials and it doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense when you realize that in verse 39, we're told many Samaritans from that town believed in Jesus because of this woman's testimony. God used a person who was the wrong race, the wrong gender, the wrong side of the tracks, the wrong side of morality, and yet she turned an entire town upside down for the gospel. What I want to do with our remaining time is consider, what is it about this Samaritan woman that suddenly made her words incredibly attractive? Because her lifestyle clearly would not have made her attractive when it comes to matters of religion. And telling her fellow Samaritans, I just had a fascinating conversation with a Jewish man, that wouldn't have helped her message either. You know, I think what made her message attractive, it was her courage, it was the change in her life, and it's what I would call a come-and-see mentality. So first, I find her courage to be incredibly attractive. In verse 28, we're told that after her encounter with Jesus, the text says, she went away into town and said to the people, come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Typically, when we think of the word courage, we reserve it for perhaps acts of valor. You know, a soldier on the battlefield, perhaps a kid standing up to a bully at school. But here in this passage, there's a different kind of courage that's at work. And I find that the kind of courage displayed here is really one of the most powerful forms of courage that you can ever come across. Sociologist Brené Brown, she has one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time. It's a talk called The Power of Vulnerability. And she didn't mention this in her talk, but she would later acknowledge that it was actually the authenticity and the vulnerability of Christians that actually led her back to Christianity. And she made this point that the word courage originally meant something different than the way we picture it today. The original definition of courage, when it first was introduced into the English language, it was taken from the Latin word cor, which means heart. And the original definition of courage was this. It's to tell the story of who you are with your whole heart. And if you think about it in that way, this Samaritan woman suddenly looks like Forrest Gump saving his friend Lieutenant Dan. It's really clear from the dialogue with Jesus that she did not want to talk about her dating life at all. That was an off-limits conversation. But Jesus pressed in. Well, here's how she tried to bait him. The hot topic of the day was what you stand on the monuments issue. Is it on our mountain or on the mountain of Jerusalem? And so she tried to bait Jesus with a topic or a conversation that she or that he would have interest in. She thought she could distract him. But by the end of the conversation, everything changed. She suddenly had the courage to bring up a topic in public that she didn't even want to talk about in private with a man named Jesus. And notice in this passage how John wants us to feel the significance of what is happening here with her courage to be vulnerable. Because he actually, there's only one phrase in this entire passage that John goes out of his way to repeat a second time. There in verse 39, he says, many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of a woman's testimony. And there it's mentioned again. He told me all that I ever did. I love so many things about this woman. She really is a beautiful example of what it means to live on mission. And I love the fact that she did not have a seminary education. I love the fact that she was speaking in the context of a culture where if you were a woman, you were kind of a second-class citizen, and you were on the fringe of conversations like this. But she had the courage to tell the story of who she was with her whole heart. And if you look throughout the scriptures, I wish we had more time to look there, but you'll find that in the scriptures, whenever God teaches his people and prepares them for something, what he will often do is he tells them, you cannot grab hold of your future until you're willing to come clean about your past. So here's the question. What does it look like to own your story? You know, for one, it might mean stop trying to convince yourself that the key to being a good witness as a Christian is to try to convince people in the outside world that you've got it all together. Maybe that isn't as effective as we might think. How could we use social media as a way of enhancing our vulnerability, as opposed to how we often use it now, which is as a moment to perfectly position our Bible, our coffee mug, and a nice scenic background and hashtag blessed. You know, I would imagine some of you at various points in time, maybe you've been encouraged to talk to somebody in the church, a pastor, elder, or women's shepherding team. Maybe to go see a counselor about things that you've been dealing with and struggling with. But up until this point, you've really resisted those notions. Is it possible that that's actually holding you back? It's keeping you from owning your story. Tending to your own story is incredibly important if you want to have the opportunity to tend to the stories of others. You know, second, I find that real life change, it's incredibly attractive. You know, I just mentioned one change, which is precisely the fact that she was able to have conversations about realities that up until this moment, she would rather not talk about at the water cooler. But there's another subtle change. If you look at verse 28, the text says that right after her conversation with Jesus, so the woman left her water jar and went away to town. She came to this place to get water. But after her conversation with Jesus, it seems really small, but her agenda changed. Her priorities changed. She was going after things that she wasn't going after before. Things shifted. I love the story in John 9 about a time that Jesus healed a man that was born blind and gave him sight. Jesus came and he healed him. Afterwards, everybody in the town was all abuzz, and they're trying to figure out what happened to this man. He's always been blind, but now he can see. And so his neighbors came up to him, asked for what was going on. He told them the story of what happened to Jesus. Then you had the Pharisees. They did the same thing. And then finally, there was this group of religious leaders who came into town, and they were fascinated by the story. They wanted to figure out what happened. So they came up to this man, and they basically said, is it really true that you were once blind? And who's this Jesus guy? Tell us that really he's just a trickster, that it's a hoax. And in reality, he's just like a big old sinner. And I love this blind man's response, or this former blind man's response. He said, listen, whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. All I know is I was blind, but now I can see. You know, one of the greatest gifts that you can give to those wrestling with their faith one of the greatest gifts you can give your kids is the ability to experience present change because of the gospel in your life. Another story from the Gospels, several days after, this probably four or five after Jesus's death. In Luke 24, there's a time where a couple of the disciples, they're walking on a road to Emmaus. And out of nowhere, Jesus shows up and starts carrying on a conversation with them. Well, at the time, they did not really realize that Jesus had actually risen from the dead. And so they didn't recognize him at first. At least not until Jesus then opened up the scriptures and started talking about all the things that he came to do. And as those two disciples recounted that moment when they first encountered Jesus and began to realize that it really was him and that he had risen from the dead, here's how they talked about this experience. They said, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened up to us the scriptures?" When's the last time you opened up the scriptures and you were suddenly confronted with Jesus face to face? You were convicted by something. You know, when's the last time you asked somebody because of a moment that you had with Jesus to forgive you for something? Whether it's bitterness, withholding love, withholding grace, whatever it may be. Can you be convicted by sin in your life now as a Christian as when you first became a Christian? You know, if you're a parent, I will guarantee you that your kids see your need for forgiveness. You don't need to convince them that you are in need of forgiveness as a parent. The question really is, do you model for them what it looks like to pursue forgiveness in your life? That's the real question. Do they see you living out your need for forgiveness and pursuing that forgiveness in your vertical relationship with God, in your horizontal relationships, in your marriage, your parenting, in your friendships, and with your neighbors? Some of you may be at a point where you're like, I realize very easily my need for forgiveness. I've got lots of areas where I need change. Be encouraged. In fact, I would never be more encouraged than when you've gotten to a place where Jesus is actually humbling you and showing you your need for change. In Hebrews 12:10, we're told, "For the Lord disciplines the one he loves. He disciplines us for our good, that we may share in his holiness." And so the idea there is that when God is confronting you with areas where you need to change and grow in your life, those are the moments where you should most feel loved by Jesus. Because what it means is that there's a softness that God has created in you, such that God has his hands on you and he's actually shaping you. Realizing your brokenness should be one of the greatest assurances that Jesus is up to something in your life and that perhaps he is preparing you for something big. Third, you know, what made this Samaritan woman suddenly so attractive is that she had what I would call a come and see mentality. In verse 29, we're told, "She went away into town and said to the people, 'Come, see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?' And they went out of the town and were coming to him." Now, on the flip side of this, you know, I wonder if one of the reasons our invitations to invite people to come and see why they don't tend to be very effective is because we're not living out the two previous points. You see, if you don't have the courage to tell your story with your whole heart, if the gospel isn't changing your life, then maybe that's why the invitations to invite people to consider Christianity falls on deaf ears. But if you do have the courage to tell your story to others, if the gospel is currently shaping and changing you, even if the people around you don't realize that the Holy Spirit has been the one who's been doing that work, then this come and see mentality, it becomes really just a natural consequence of those two previous realities. And what I love about this mentality is that you don't need to have a seminary education. You don't need to be on staff at the church. You don't need to be fluent in the scriptures or be skilled in apologetics. All you need is the ability to invite people to come and see what you are experiencing. If you go back to when Jesus first called Philip as one of his 12 apostles, Philip met with Jesus. Then he decided, I am going to talk to my buddy Nathaniel, and I'm going to tell him everything that I've just experienced. And so he does that. He says, Nathaniel, I have found the guy we've been waiting for, the Messiah, and it's this guy Jesus of Nazareth. And then Nathaniel's response was this. I appreciate the honesty, the skepticism. He says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? And here was Philip's response. Come and see. His friend came and he saw. You know, I was writing my sermon this week at a coffee shop here in Raleigh. And as I was working on my sermon, I looked up for a moment and I read the headline on the newspaper that somebody was reading. And the headline was this, UNC at impasse on fate of Confederate statue. And, you know, some of you may be aware that I've written a blog post about my perspective on the topic this week. And I've got friends on both sides of this really hot debate. And so one of the things that I'm trying to do as a pastor is where appropriate to try to stir the pot, so to speak, to force us to really engage theologically with current events around us. I want us to hold the newspaper in one hand, the scriptures in the other, and to figure out how those two can intersect in a gospel-centered and thoroughly biblical manner. But this passage in John 4, I thought, was very apropos. We need to remember what's going on here in John 4. Because Jesus and this Samaritan woman, at one point, their conversation turned towards a conversation about monuments, right? And the question really boiled down to this. Is the presence of God found in this temple, or is it found in that temple? And I love Jesus' answer. He said, neither. If you're looking for the presence of God, it isn't about this building or that building. It's not about finding the right building. It's about finding the right person. And I who speak to you am He, Jesus said. And that's really what this story is about. It's about a woman who had the courage to let Jesus into her story that she might own it. And in the presence of Jesus, she changed. And that change was infectious. You know, here at Midtown Church, we take communion every week because it really serves as a reminder, a perpetual reminder for us as the Church of Jesus Christ about where we go in order to experience change. And one of the things I love about the symbolism of communion is that the gospel says you don't have to change in order to come to Jesus. You just have to have the courage to tell the story of who you are before Jesus. And Jesus will do the change for you. You know, this sacrament is for people who have put their faith in Jesus. People who've come to a point in their life where they have said, I want you to know my story, Jesus, and I want you to change it. and I want you to change me. And so the sacrament is for anybody who's come to that place in their life where they look to Jesus for true life change. Now, if there's anybody here today who hasn't put their faith in Jesus, if you feel like you're the woman at the well who's still trying to figure out who he really is, then I'd encourage you not to take the sacrament yet. Wait until the point in time comes where you feel like you really do trust the words of Jesus, that he is the one you come to for all life change. And so if you're not there yet, feel free to use this portion of the service to spend in silent reflection as you begin having conversations with Jesus. Continue coming to Midtown, asking questions as you wrestle with the claims of Jesus Christ. However, if you put your faith in Jesus, if you've gotten to a point where you want Jesus to change and to shape you, this is where you come to experience change. Now, if you're taking the sacrament this morning, here's how I want you to prepare your heart. As you consider coming up, ask yourself this question. What's the story that I need to tell Jesus right now? What is it that I need to be courageous about? And maybe it's something that's happened this past week, something that you've been struggling with for quite some time, that you haven't really trusted that you could have a conversation with Jesus and that he would actually be able to do something beautiful in the midst of that story. What's the story you need to tell? Start having that conversation. Come up to receive these elements and know that Jesus is not only present to hear, but he is powerful to change. Now, Jesus wants us to remember that on the night before he was betrayed, he took the bread and he broke it and he gave it to his disciples and he said, "This represents my body that was broken for you." And after the supper, he took the cup and he said, "This cup, it represents my blood that was shed for many for the forgiveness of sins. Drink from it, all of you." Now, if this is your first time taking communion here at Midtown Community Church, we'll ask that when you're ready, you'll just come up front to receive the elements. You pinch off a piece of bread. If you need a gluten-free option, I will have that in my line. And then you will take a cup from the tray. The outer ring is grape juice. The inner ring is also grape juice. So we are all grape juice going forward. But come and receive the sacrament of communion. Let me pray, and if those who are coming to serve would do so at this time. Heavenly Father, oftentimes we really struggle to be honest about what's really going on in our life. But we often forget the fact that you, Jesus, just like with the Samaritan woman, you know all the worst parts of our stories. You know our struggles. You know our brokenness. You know our need. And the gospel says that you bid us to come, even when we lack that courage. And so I really thank you for that. I thank you for the sacrament of communion. And I pray this morning that in the knowledge that you know all things and you love all people, that you would give us the courage to come, to tell our story to you, and to let us feed on you in a spiritual way, that your gospel might change us. We pray this in your name. Amen.